Well, I'd like to thank the organizers for giving me this opportunity to present this work. I'm going to introduce the concept of what we call active steering in the cytoskeleton. And it's actually very similar to what Dave Waits talked about today in the second part of his talk, and where we arrive at similar conclusions, but from a different angle, in which instead of using inert probe particles, we technically wiretap kinesin inside the cell and then interrogate this active fluctuations inside the cell cytoskeleton. And this work has been done in the group of Christoff Schmidt. The theory has been worked out by Fred McIntosh, and the carbon nanotubes that I will introduce them and later show you how we can use them has been provided by Matteo Pasquali's lab in Rice University, where I did my PhD. So, as we all know, cell cytoskeleton is a highly dynamic composite material, a combination of these polymeric networks from microtubules to filamentous actin, along with intermediate filaments, as well as the membrane. If we combine these things, they actually render the mechanics of mechanical properties of this highly composite, highly dynamic material. And then we have, on the other hand, we have metabolism, which keeps this material out of equilibrium. And if you look at this system very closely, as you can see, it's a highly, first of all, it's a nearly elastic material, and it's also quite crowded. And it turns out that transport inside this highly confined and crowded environment is it's quite complicated. First of all, as you can imagine, it's a soft material. So at very short time scales, we have thermal fluctuations. And then obviously, it's very crowded. So if cell wants to move things around in this composite networks, it actually uses this trick of directed motion. And a lot of non-equilibrium processes inside the cell are directed, all the way from polymerization of microtubules and actin, as well as a classic example, which is kinesin and dynein motor protein transport. And so if you see, generally, when people want to classify this kind of transport inside the cell, they usually look at the mean square displacement, and they classify the motion as being either subdiffusive, which shows us that we have some confinement, all the way to directed motion, which is the signature of directed transport. And in the middle of this, in the middle of these two timescales, we a lot of times we see this signature of what appears to be thermal motion, and that's what I'm going to talk about this part. And so there are different ways to look at this range of dynamics. Obviously, it's a scale-dependent dynamics. And one way, as Dave Waits talked about it this morning, is to introduce inert probe particles and look at their motion, or actively manipulate them and look at their response. But another way which to do this is to look at the proteins, the endogenous proteins inside the cell, and look at their long distance transport. And however, one of the complications to do this is if you want to look at a single protein in this highly complex environment, if you want to look, for example, use a fluorescent and look at a very large over decades, obviously they photobleed. So we really don't get the whole spectrum of timescales that we are interested in. And one thing we wanted to do is to tag kinesin, or we can also do other proteins, but we wanted to do kinesin, and then look at the long-distance transport of kinesin and try to classify all these types of transport inside the cell. And the reason we chose kinesin is because, first of all, it's a protein, so at very short time scales, obviously, it goes under thermal motion. And then it's a protein that's responsible for long-distance transport inside the cell. So you really cover this very long range of transport. And to do so, we take advantage of single-walled carbon nanotubes. So single-walled carbon nanotubes are a tubular structure of all carbon. They have a diameter of about 1 nanometer, and their length can be anything from hundreds of nanometer to tens of microns, for example. And they have, because of this extreme shape and one-dimensionality, they have many interesting properties. One property is that they, because of this extreme geometry, some of them behave essentially as semiconductors. So they have this Van Hoff singularities in the band gap structure. So what happens is that you get this intrinsic fluorescence where you can excite them between 500 to about 800. And then the emission fluorescence is the wavelength is above 900. And in a way, you can get actually different flavors because each of these is a fingerprint of the nanotube. So if you can imagine, if you have different way of wrapping these nanotubes, you get different peaks here, which are quite sharp. And also, as you can see, they're shifted quite largely. And for example, this is one example. It's a 6-5 nanotube, and you get this very sharp peak here. Other properties of this fluorescence is that it doesn't photobleach. It also doesn't blink. And another aspect of it is that because we have this one-dimensional object, the fluorescence is highly anisotropic. So if you imagine, you know how you track, you attach it to the protein, you somehow can look at the orientation at the same time that you are looking at a position. Other thing is that here I'm showing you this very long nanotube. It's about 20 micron, and it's embedded in actin gel. So they have, because they're only 1 nanometer, they can thread through the meshwork here. So here, this is actually another project. It's my favorite project. And you can see that it's actually moving through the network. And for the very long ones, you get these thermal fluctuations where you can look at the thermal fluctuations and, for example, measure the viscoelastic properties of actin. But I'm not going to talk about that. But the point is that they can thread through or reptate through this meshwork here. So a combination of these properties, we thought that would be very interesting to tag proteins and look at the long-distance transport. And the way to do it is, obviously, they're carbon, so they're quite hydrophobic. You have to render them water-soluble. So what we do is that we wrap them with single-stranded DNA, which has a functional group in on the 5N. And from this functional group, you can come up with chemistries to covalently label specific proteins inside the cell. There are a few important things that one has to take into account. First of all, we need a monofunctional group, so it's in a way we can play with the length of the DNA here and then have tune the number of proteins that you want to attach to this protein, to this nanotube. And then also we use this halo tag technology where we attach this halo tag protein is a 34 kilodalton dehalogenase, bacterial dehalogenase, where when it actually cleaves a halogen from this aliphatic carbon. So we transfect our cells with this halo tag protein and then introduce nanotubes with this halo ligand and then get this very specific and highly stable link here. And then, so this is an example. So this, all I'm showing you is wide field imaging, so there is no need for turf or anything because we have extremely high signals to noise ratio. So what you see is that it's a cell that has been transfected with kinesin, and then we electroporated nanotubes inside the cell, and they find their counterpart, the pro-counterpart protein, and then you can here clearly see signatures of kinesin transport, which is this long-distance transport. You can also see some of them that are stationary, and so I come back to all. It's in a way we can now look at all sorts of transport inside the cell. It's a single nanotube, so you can do spectroscopy. So here I show you. So first of all, you get this really high signal-to-noise ratio, and you can do simultaneously spectroscopy to make sure that you have a single one. If there are multiple, then you get this broadening of the peak and shift, so you can actually make sure that you are looking at single ones. And well, you can also have different colors. So we use one color here, but you can imagine that you can tag different proteins and look at this what you are interested in. And because they're very stable, we can really pump them quite high, strongly, and we can go all the way to 5 millisecond exposure time, and again get this really high signal to noise ratio. So this is a maximum intensity projection of this kinesin movement, and as you can see, we can image from 5 milliseconds all the way to 500 seconds. So it's about a five order of magnitude decades that we can actually look at the transport. So the first thing was to make sure that actually kinesin is doing what it's supposed to be doing. So you have this rod attached to it. So we looked at behavior of kinesin, which is it has a certain velocity. So you can see that a single one, which we can track for very long times, and we see the distribution of the velocity. Even a single one has different kinds of velocities. And so this really you can also do all in vitro studies to make sure that it's monofunctional, and I'm not going to go through all those, but we make sure that it's the protein is doing what it's supposed to be doing. We can also, just this slide, I can show you that we can also do it in whole animals. So if you're interested in looking at the dynamics in, for example, C. elegans, here I show a long-distance transport of kinesin in neurons of C. elegans. And again, it's wide field imaging, so you can see that it's quite, you get a very high signal to noise ratio, and you can look at a long. 100 nanometers, yeah. So it's actually, we can't go below that because the fluorescence is an excitonic process, and then that's the exciton length. So, okay, so getting back to what we really want, so we look at this, so we can see this directed transport, and it's nice, but now we wanted to see what else is affecting this directed transport. So if you look at it here, so kinesin is moving on these microtubules, and if you look at this highway of microtubules, it's actually very dynamic. And microtubules are obviously embedded in this actomyosin network. So one thing we thought would be interesting to see how this actomyosin network is affecting the dynamics of our kinesin. And because we can find the center of the, we can locate the kinesin with high accuracy, we can get these tracks, and then we know that microtubules are quite stiff, so we can fit, we can do a fit to this trace here and look at the off-axis, the transverse, and the longitudinal motion. And then we can see that obviously the longitudinal motion is the signature of a directed transport. And then we have this transverse motion, which is quite noisy here. So one thing, the first thing we did was to look at the mean square displacement of these traces. So as expected for the longitudinal transport, we get this directed transport, almost 2. But what was puzzling was that, what we didn't expect was to get a mean square displacement of 1 for the transverse motion. So one thing one has to realize that it's different from the beads because we have this very long microtubules, and we know that they are confined to this actomyosin gel. So we would expect to see we would expect to see a much exponent much lower than 1 because it's confined. So, and then another signature was that we see this flattening here as at a time scale, which I called this correlation time scale here. And that was the other thing that was interesting and maybe puzzling. So one thing we did next was we suspected that myosin could be actually driving this this behavior, this what appears to be a diffusive motion. And indeed, if you use a drug blebbistatin reduce the activity of myosin, you can see that in the black line shows that the directed motion is not affected. But the transverse motion is, it becomes more and more to close to what we actually expect. And here you can see that if we look at the alphas, we see that the directed motion is not affected, but the transverse motion has been reduced. Another interesting thing is that the alpha that we get from transverse motion in the non-treated cells is about 1.1, which I'm actually going to come back to that later. So this is when Fred proposed this theory that in order to explain what we see, we can model the mice in behavior as this creating this random step-like forces in the network. And what happens is that now we have a combination of two forces in the network. One is, if we assume that it's a fully elastic network, then we have this thermal-driven fluctuations. And then this signature, this type of Meissen behavior, will give us a omega minus 2 behavior. And then a combination of these two, this is obviously it's in a frequency space, but if we go into mean square displacement, a combination of two will explain what we see. So we have this MSD from active fluctuations caused by the Meissen, which has this thermal signature here. And then we have the mean square displacement of the thermal fluctuations in a nearly elastic material, and that has this signature here. So a combination of two can explain this the 1.1 exponent that we see. So now, again, we go back to see in the picture, to see what's happening in the picture. So we have the directed motion. We have this, obviously, if objects are big, we would expect to see this nearly elastic, in a nearly elastic and passive network, we would see an exponent lower than 1. And then if the objects are very small, they would behave essentially just, for example, ions, they would just diffuse in the network without really feeling the network. And then in this intermediate regime, we have a cell uses this interesting trick where by introducing these force fluctuations, it actually creates this, in a way, one can say that it fluidizes this nearly elastic material so it can move around these bigger objects or proteins. And actually to see that if this hypothesis is correct, we can also look at the proteins, the kinesins, that are not attached to the microtubules. So we had instances that where we had a kinesin kind of diffusing around, and then it would decide to move. So we know that the nanotubes is attached to the kinesin. And then we can look at this mean square displacement for very short times and for intermediate times. And then we get this beautiful S-curve here, where at very short times, we have the thermal motion, the signature of the thermal motion in the network. At intermediate times, we get this, because of this random force fluctuations, we get this what appears to be thermal. And then at long times, because the Meissen correlation time is finite, we get this leveling off here. And by using this a combination of thermal force and this motor force, we can actually fit theoretical curve through our data. And indeed, if we use blebbistatin, we see that this thermal signature kind of starts going down, and it becomes more and more what is actually expected from an elastic material. Okay, so just to wrap up, so I showed you that nanotubes are this stable, unbleachable probe, so they can be used in many different applications. They give you very high signal-to-noise ratio, so you can follow them for very long times. And we have come up with efficient ways of targeting, so we can look at, in principle, different proteins. So we use them as a technique to look at this high bandwidth intracellular tracking, and obviously we can do multicolor labeling. And we showed that there is an intermediate regime where this active intercellular forces create this thermal motion in an elastic material. And so it's because they're quite thin, you can actually now think of doing this kind of fluctuations in even tighter environments, such as cell nucleus. So here I have attached this nuclear localization signal to the nanotubes, and then we can look at the transport through the nuclear pore complex and then introduce them in the nucleus and look at the fluctuations in the nucleus. So with that, I'd be happy to take questions.
Can you measure the off rates of the kinesin from the microtubule from your experiments?
I think in principle, yes, it should be possible.
You saw these fluctuations in velocity.
Yes.
Do we see the kinesin going on and off in these fluctuations?
I think in the cell, it's a bit hard to tell if it's actually coming off or still on the microtubule.
So it goes off and it comes back on the same microtubule, or does it go away?
Yeah, I think it's too messy to really know exactly if it's coming back to the same microtubules or just going off.
But we have in vitro
measurements where we can actually, because we know that the microtubule.
So in vitro, it diffuses away, no?
It depends. Sometimes it just. I maybe should show you actually an example. So this is an in vitro measurement. So we have microtubules on the surface, and then, for example, this kinesin is walking, diffuses, and then kind of switches back to the one next to it.
But in the cell, there are probably more than one motor or one vesicle.
I have a quick comment about just technical aspect with the mean squared displacement. You seem to be spending a lot of your time categorizing mean squared displacement. Could you not try something else, like maybe angular correlations or first passage probabilities?
Sure. I mean, you can get really high resolution data, so I think it's open to all sorts of.
So I think there's a lot more there rather than just this diffusive behavior. You'd see
anti-correlated
motion. You'd see lots of other fun things.
Yeah, I think there's so many data that you can.
Sure.
But mean squared displacement was just the simplest.
Okay, yeah, but just saying it's t to the 1 MSD, I mean, I know there's lots of other ways of you could get more detail from it. I think it's just the point, really. Okay.
You mentioned that you could also use these probes inside the nucleus.
Yes.
What do you see?
So this is, I just started working on it, but the idea is that to attach them to specific sites in the nucleus, and then, for example, histones, or you can have this DNA overhang and then attach them to different parts of chromatin, and then look at the fluctuations in the nucleus. For example, stem cells versus differentiated cells.
Hold on for the mic.
Change the volume, cell volume.
No, but I guess we can do that. So.
Okay, so let's thank Nietzsche again.